pigeonholing. Despite the undeniable success of the other white guy, DJ continually assured me that everything was copacetic with Hot Carl. When we lightly started to discuss details, I decided I would name my album Your Housekeeper Hates You, a statement I believed most Caucasian families I grew up around should have to come to terms with. Production costs continued to roll in, and the monthly stipend had come to an end, yet Interscope extended it for 4 more months without flinching. My days may have been dismal as I battled my concern about my parents and watched Marshall Mathers soar, but at night I continued with late-night recording sessions and a somewhat lavish lifestyle that was still undeniably exciting. Maddie Sancho and I were as strong as ever, constantly performing around Los Angeles and making stops in Arizona and Reno for shows at college parties. The label continued to make big moves, now serious about getting Christina Aguilera to sing the hook on Caliente Carlito, an idea I had the moment she lost her shit after hearing my name. DJ also promised me the song was still on schedule to be remade by Timbaland, who would only become more popular during the wait. But nothing proved Interscope's undying interest in Hot Carl more than its willingness to entertain my desire to include a childhood hero of mine on the album. While talk of multi-platinum guest musicians steadily flowed, I focused on the one name that had meant the most to childhood Jensen while he wrapped into a comb and danced in front of the mirror. The person wasn't well-known or particularly famous, but he was the first credible white MC I ever saw, and he had given me hope that I too could be a rapper. I wanted MC Search from the seminal rap group Third Base on my record, and once again, I didn't hear no. When Search asked for $15,000 to appear on the song, I assumed the label would balk and laugh at his request, considering he hadn't rapped on a track in over a decade, let alone had a song on the radio. He'd be making as much as Fabolous, who was quickly becoming one of New York's most promising MCs, with 2 songs on the charts and deafening buzz in the streets. No one would be buying my album because MC Search was on it, which was a requirement I knew had to be met for them to spend that type of money on a feature. But when DJ asked me how much Search's involvement meant to me as a person, I was quick to state my case. I explained how he was my sole inspiration to start rapping, and that I'd always looked to him to see what was acceptable and what wasn't for a rapper born outside the race that invented the form. I told DJ how I teared up when Search walked out to freestyle as a surprise guest during a Redman and Method Man concert at the House of Blues I had attended during college. I revealed it was my lifelong dream to collaborate with Search, but if the price was too high and it seemed impossible to get approved, I would understand and genuinely appreciate his attempts. And after 1 phone call, 5 minutes later, I was planning a song with MC Search. The streak of approvals continued, and the tracklist of my eventual album started to take shape. Not only would it feature producers and guest artists who made the product viable in the marketplace, Maya, Redman, DJ Clue, Fabolous, Sugar Ray, but I would be staying true to myself in both content and spirit. I could see the finish line. As I imagined what the next year would look like, expecting to experience the fame and recognition constantly promised to me by 12 employees and the president of the label, I never could have predicted what came next. If I had, I would have quickly started looking for another job. Chapter 18: The Worst Phone Call. Months after MC Search confirmed his participation, I found myself more at ease than ever. My father's cancer was showing signs of remission. After positively reacting to treatment, my mom broke out of her funk to start dating, and I moved a street away from Maddie in Brentwood. My carefree days consisted of writing raps and playing video games, a job I would have killed for at 12 years old, and still would. I had a call scheduled with the product manager to begin the process of leaking songs to college DJs and planning a music video, which would kick off a timeline that would end with the release of Your Housekeeper Hates You. Finally, the gears were in motion to accomplish my ultimate goal. I was ready for a life-changing call, which I did end up receiving that week. It just wasn't the call I was expecting. That Monday, I received an email from DJ explaining that the project manager call would be postponed while they worked out some details, so I casually went back to writing over some new beats. A few days later, when an Interscope employee called me unexpectedly, I figured it was to reschedule the meeting or to go over some ideas during the wait. However, when I heard the tone of his voice dramatically change, a shift I'd experience again years later when a nurse hinted that my brain's x-rays had more blemishes than a teenage Adam Levine, I realized we were about to talk about something much more serious. But no matter how quickly my instincts picked up his somberness, I had no idea exactly how much his words would hurt. I trusted this employee. Since every encounter we'd had up until this point was straightforward and genuine, 2 words I couldn't use when describing most people I met in the music industry, or any industry for that matter. He started the conversation by asking if I'd be able to keep his identity completely secret, no matter how emotional I became about what he was going to reveal. I laughed, asking if this was about his involvement in the JonBenet Ramsey case, because I'd always had my suspicions. He didn't hear me. He admitted he was taking a very big risk here and needed to feel like I understood that gamble. I promised him anonymity, something I've been able to keep for over a decade. This is truly the first time I've ever repeated the details of that call. I thought he was just going to say, "I'm fucking with you," and then I'd return to figuring out new ways to make fun of Tyrese. But instead he told me that this new revelation was as difficult for him to understand as it would be for me to hear. With that, he told me to leave Interscope Records immediately. I was inclined to hang up and pretend I'd never gotten this call. He began talking again, but I didn't hear the words. I stood motionless and the wall started to close in, like that camera trick they do in movies when a wife hears that her husband died overseas. He wasn't heavily involved in every aspect of my project, so I could just play it off as hearsay, but he was speaking directly to my fears. My anxiety took over. I had no plan B. Leaving Interscope after all the hype would not only make Hot Carl appear tainted to any other label, it would also totally break my spirit. In recent years, musicians leaving or being dropped from record labels has become more of an opening for other companies to come in and seize the opportunity. But during my run in the early 2000s, it only hurt your reputation. It made you look like you couldn't deliver. Minutes before the call, my career had been on track. Now it was a train wreck. He informed me that everything was about to change. The blind spending would come to an end, and I would now take a backseat to basically every other artist on the label. He revealed that my biggest fear was coming true. They had decided to never put out my album. As I grasped for any possibility that he could be wrong, I felt the tears well up in my eyes. I fought every inclination to break down, unwilling to let him know just how much this was crushing me. I calmly asked if he knew why this was happening. He said that the label would be creative with their explanation, but the truth was that someone wanted the project stopped. He said it involved a conflict with another artist, but didn't reveal which individual specifically. But by reading between the lines, I understood it came from somewhere in Marshall Mathers' direction. I couldn't think of one reason this employee would lie to me, even though I so badly wanted to find one. We kept the talk short. I bit my lip, hoping not to reveal that I was now crying. Before he hung up, he told me how talented I was and how unfair this situation had become, which is why he'd called. He didn't want to leave me hanging. He said it was the least he could do. He hoped I wouldn't kill the messenger, but instead look for a better situation to get my album heard, a mission he thought was culturally important, but understood would now be difficult. He asked me again to never reveal my source, and I thanked him. I hung up the phone, unsure of what to do next. As I lay in bed that night, unable to sleep, I felt the OTD trickle back into my brain. I feared that everything I had done up to this point now meant nothing, and I wasn't sure I had the skills to cope with that. I hoped my source had heard it wrong, or that this was some sort of cruel joke conjured up during a lunch break, but I knew that wasn't the case. I stayed awake for the entire night, anxious, knowing this would not end well. I saw the sun come up. I tried to keep a positive attitude, knowing that everything could change at any moment, but as predicted, my communication with DJ and the label was drastically minimized. They stopped calling me altogether and would return only about half my calls. When we did talk, I had to keep a poker face, somewhat annoyed by being ignored, but not tipping anyone off to the news I had secretly received. DJ, once a fixture in my everyday life, had all but become a stranger. I knew the position well, having seen Will.i.am similarly shun the previous year. As quickly as the open budget had brought in friends, a closed one pushed them away even faster. A mutual industry pal told me that Timbaland, the star once aligned to reproduce Caliente Carlito, was now allegedly saying that he was only going to work with me because he was contractually obligated to by Interscope. A future trip to New York was canceled as the label readjusted strategy, and studio sessions were getting harder and harder to approve. Reimbursements were becoming chores, with months passing before I'd be paid back for expenses of even $100. If Eminem was E.T., I became Mac and Me, the copycat remake no one cared about. The anonymous caller was right. I was no longer a priority. Things were falling apart quicker than they'd come together. Had I not been warned of the tides turning, I would have sat around for years, blaming bad music or bad breath or anything I could fault for the label's cold feet. No matter how depressed or obsessive I was becoming or how much I wanted to just curl up into a ball and retreat, I knew I had to act. I called Fred Davis and informed him of everything that had happened. He was confident that he could convince Jimmy to cut to the chase and avoid dragging out this holding pattern for too long, letting me attempt to salvage any career I might still have left. Leaving Interscope without releasing any music, an act I'd never imagined could actually happen, was now something I could no longer avoid. I was devastated, but I knew if I was actually going to do this, I wanted to meet with Jimmy Iovine one last time. I wanted him to tell me exactly what had happened, why he was unable to keep the promises he'd once made. I wanted him to explain it to my face. With that, I asked Fred to hold off on any communication with Interscope lawyers as I set up my own appointment with the man who had once offered me the world. After some calls, I was scheduled to meet with Jimmy a few weeks later. It was a far cry from the instant access I used to have, but I knew I needed answers, and there wasn't a fucking salmon plate in the world that could calm me down. As I waited for my rendezvous with Jimmy to take place, I coincidentally ran into my old friend Bubba Sparks. I was happy to see Bubba and hoped he could calm my nerves, especially in a time of such turmoil, but he seemed just as rattled as I was. The round and innocent rapper I'd first met had given way to a thinner, more antagonistic Bubba, now with the words New South aggressively tattooed on his forearms. He was knee-deep in work on his second release, Deliverance, an album eventually all but thrown in the trash by Interscope's marketing department, despite it being one of the most underrated hip-hop albums of the 2000s. He seemed so much angrier than when we first met, admitting that he also felt ignored by the label and didn't know how much longer he'd last. Similarly to my situation, a different Interscope executive had privately warned him about the world's most powerful rapper, but instead of it involving his declining position at the label, it was to alert him that Eminem had dissed him on an upcoming song. Bubba was visibly angry, mentioning that he had friends back home who wouldn't appreciate that type of talk. A violent threat I never could have imagined coming from his smiling mouth back when we were both the toast of the office in 2000. Now defeated, we understood that our blind optimism was, in reality, bullshit. The diss from Eminem never actually came to fruition, but it caused such obvious paranoia in Bubba that you'd have to assume it contributed to his demise at the label, which happened a few years later. As much as Bubba's attitude concerned me, I knew where it came from. I shared that rage. I related to that need for revenge. I deserved answers. The talk of my project all but disappeared. Whatever buzz was left disappeared. Soon thereafter, the Los Angeles Times wrote an article detailing my story and issues with the label, as well as the stories of other white rappers having a hard time fitting into a post-Eminem world. They interviewed me for the piece, which wondered if another white rapper would ever find success in the industry, a question that can now only be laughed at, considering most popular MCs in 2016 look like they work at a PacSun. While other labels mentioned in the article were quick to retaliate and blame the artist for their failures, Interscope was the only company that declined to comment. I watched what was left of my initial advance dwindle every month without any viable plan for future revenue. I traded in my Expedition for a Mercury Cougar in what the appraiser joked was the MC Hammer special. He laughed and laughed and laughed at that one. I didn't. I obsessed over every little decision I made, wondering if I should have just focused on my college education and forced any dream of a rap career back into the realm of fantasy where it belonged. Should I have signed with Mac-10? The firm? Anywhere other than Interscope? Should I have changed my natural voice and immediately avoided any comparisons to Eminem? Why did I have to pick a name that involved shitting? I withdrew even further from friends and family. It all felt too painful to deal with. The optimism I'd experienced over the past year had now expired, with an entire album of songs sitting on a shelf at Interscope, collecting dust instead of royalties. These tracks represented more than just possible club bangers or number one hits. They were also my soul. And now it was all taken away so fast. Eventually, I was officially told that the Hot Crawl record would never see the light of day. Interscope publicly cited scheduling conflicts for the decision, a term that actually seemed to address the internal conflict at the label, yet give no details at the same time. It was as vague as they could be. I was basically retired by the company that had once touted me as the next big thing and then spent over $500,000 to produce a CD that now was more likely to be a drink coaster than a source of music. As I drove to my meeting with Jimmy, I promised I would make him pay for what he did to me. I sat across from Jimmy Iovine for the second time in my life, this time under drastically different conditions. We were alone in his office, a condition I had requested but figured wouldn't be honored. Not surprisingly, the intensity of the situation ended up intimidating me much more than it intimidated him. The bright-eyed, optimistic college student ready to hear how famous he'd be had now given way to an unshaven and 30 pounds heavier poster boy for disappointment. I hadn't even talked about my rap career in a month. We stared at each other for a few seconds before talking, Jimmy once again hidden under a baseball cap and me fighting back the urge to break each of the platinum records that covered his office's walls. There was one unhung plaque on his floor for 50 Cent, a rapper who had clearly lapped me since our few minutes together in Canada. This meeting could go many ways, but I knew that, no matter what, Jimmy Iovine was going to change the course of my life once again. The silence was broken as he began to explain the current dilemma of my project. He was indistinct yet polite, waxing poetic in his shrieking, high-pitched voice about scheduling conflicts, and how if I stuck around for a bit, the congestion might lighten up and we could take another look at it down the road. I asked if this had anything to do with Eminem, and he laughed at the notion. I have a ton of similar rock groups, and what they have in common doesn't stop me from releasing their music, Jimmy argued, forgetting he had also used that angle when explaining why I should sign there. When I asked how I'd be able to stick around if I wasn't making any income, he didn't have an immediate answer. But when he did try to lessen my fears, his suggestion was mind-blowing. He pulled out a stack of CDs from under his desk, each without official artwork or titles, almost looking like homemade mixtapes someone had burned on a computer. He said, "Maybe it's time to give you the Gerardo treatment." With that, his receptionist walked in with the only interruption our talk would endure, letting him know that Axel was on hold. He took the call, giving me time to look over the stack of CDs. I realized I was looking at the finished but unreleased albums of acts like Fourth Avenue Jones, Valeria, and Bionic Jive, musicians also on the verge of being exiled from Jimmy's empire. He hung up the phone and asked if I could ever see myself as an A&R, explaining that my sensibilities and understanding of songwriting would be assets to the company, and that this would be a great way to transition from being an artist into a career that made more sense at this point. I felt my face flush with both anger and embarrassment. I was only a few months removed from being the company's future star, and now I was being encouraged to hang it all up. Jimmy asked that I take the music home with me and email him my thoughts after a few listens. As I listened to Jimmy's offer, I realized that no matter what my goals were before I walked in, truth was, I was hardly talking. He was asking me to become the very thing that had just stopped my dreams from coming true, an A&R. Not only would I be ditching my own hopes, but I'd be involved in repeating the same pattern for other artists on the brink of success. I'd become DJ, bearing bad news to musicians who'd given their all for a chance, only to learn they were sold a plan of smoke and mirrors. He wanted me to become the enemy. I wanted to scream at him for repeating the sales pitch he had driven into my head when I had shared these initial concerns over a year ago. I wanted to remind him of how he thought Eminem and I differed, since I still didn't believe his explanation that Marshall or Marshall's management had nothing to do with this. I wanted to show my father's doctor's bills and explain that he deserved to see my album get a proper release after all the shit he'd been through, too. And I wanted to ask what the fuck Axl Rose was calling about. I wanted to say it all, but instead, I said almost nothing. I picked up the CDs and calmly announced, "I'm disappointed. This is really the worst-case scenario for me. I'll think it over and let you know." Jimmy shook my hand, and I walked out of his office and the Interscope building for the last time ever. On my way home, I called Fred Davis and told him to get me out of the deal any way he could, explaining I could never become the kind of judge and jury that had just crushed my own ambitions forever. Fred understood and promised he'd get it done. As I hung up the phone, I made the decision to retire from rap. I officially severed all ties with Interscope a week later. While still at Interscope, I had my song with MC Search to complete. When it came time to record with my childhood idol, there was only one thing on my mind: the downfall of my career at the label. I decided to make the song a report on my time in the industry, and more specifically, the neglect, broken promises, and misunderstanding of my project I experienced while working for Jimmy Iovine. I believed if I had just changed who I was, I would have gotten a chance. That's a notion I've grown to disregard. Who I am or could have become had nothing to do with it. In the intro, you hear a young, hopeful Ha Carl walk into a busy record label office asking for VP Search. I enter Search's room and excitedly start to explain how he's my hero, only to be told to hold on as he finishes up a phone call. I wait patiently while he tries to connect with Dr. Dre and St. Bart's and am completely ignored. Eventually, he hangs up.
"It's my man, Hot Kizzle. Take a load off. Have a seat. How you feeling, big dog?"
"Well, good, I think." Almost like it was a make-a-wish situation, we set up the microphones facing each other so we could have an actual conversation with each other while recording. We allowed a little room for improv, making each take different, considering that for most of my childhood, I would stand in front of the mirror pretending to be Search, and that now I was looking right at him. This was both creepy and a dream come true.
"Listen, congratulations. I just heard you got signed."
"I had to stop by. You were my favorite back when you rhymed."
"Well, that was a long time ago when the rhymes were more slow. K-Day was on radio and rappers didn't make dough, but you..."
"Creatively, I really wanted to discuss..."
"Listen, I've been thinking of a formula ever since you signed with us."
"Oh, a formula, like Search's DOC.
"Now listen, don't you get snappy with me. Now, sit down. We gotta break it down, how to make you sound. First, we'll put some freestyles in the college underground. Put out two white labels, then two CD singles. combine third base choruses into two-line jingles, put you on alternative sold-out tours, pop your collar, triple platinum, maybe four.
Wait, hold on, Search. I'm not dissing, but are you listening? I'm hip-hop, and I thought you were too. Your point I'm missing. Are you taking my vision to abuse it? I've seen this shit before on Suge Knight's Behind the Music. I remember the Cactus album. You were a trendsetter. Now you've sold out. You're like 2000's Jerry Heller.
Jerry Heller? Let me tell you something. That kid got cash.
Sorry, I'll pass. Even I know Cube got stuck in the ass.
Yep, he got cups filled with stacks, cribs filled with plaques. George Carl, give it a chance.
Who? Search wanted to keep forgetting my name throughout the song, getting it wrong over and over, and not caring about the mistakes. We figured it would make for the biggest asshole A&R either of us could ever imagine. Every time he threw out a different name, I would laugh. So when he said George Carl during one take, the name of a veteran NBA coach, I lost my shit. The who you hear was a genuine response. Me in shiny pants, doing a dance? I can already hear those sellout chants.
No, sold out, 20,000 seats in advance.
No thanks, I'll stay underground and bust a b-boy stance. I'ma stay true, even if my idol thinks I'm a joke, and I'ma keep it real.
Yeah, you're gonna keep it real, all right. Keep it real broke.
It's all about the art of hip-hop, no matter if it sells.
It's about that Carson Daly and that TRL.
We should talk about my thoughts and ideas. Give me the chance to.
We should talk about recouping that money we just advanced you.
We should talk about the love and the history from the Parks.
Yes, 106 and Park, number one on their charts.
Man, you got it all wrong. You see, that's not where I'm from.
Listen, hip-hop is a business, stupid. Don't act dumb. See, I can understand your dilemma. You're struggling to hold your soul. But after all that struggling, you need to let it go. Free your mind and the dough will flow and won't be far behind. Just think about the platinum mountain I got Nas to climb. I'm feeling a little hesitant.
Why's that?
You're being obstinate. Credibility or cheddar?
I think I'm lactose intolerant. All right, Search, I see what you see. Just another white MC, able to be packaged into cute little CDs. I'm not another gimmick. Don't sell me off my image. Don't assume my marketing until my material is finished. Because no matter what happens, it's about my satisfaction. And without a plan B, I'll be asked out like Tony Braxton. I'm hip-hop till death. What are you, insane? Imagine me with all gold teeth and a huge platinum chain.
Platinum chain. Matching fronts. Featuring Cash Money and Manny Fresh. Yes, Carl. Anything you want.
As a gift, Search actually got me gold grills with hot coral and diamonds encrusted on them. I still have them in storage, and every once in a while I'll blow someone's mind by putting them in and not saying anything until they notice. Come on, Search, I was joking.
I'm choking off the cash, I'm a clear. Carlito, Eminem ain't got shit on you this year.
I went out of my way to never mention Eminem in a song, but the plan was to be as honest as possible in these lyrics, hoping to tap into my pain through a funny and inventive concept. I knew I had to admit the comparison at some point, and since I was never able to escape it in the end, I'm happy I did. Ah, listen to this cat pigeonholing me in rap. Imagine me getting jiggy just to equal SoundScan stats. In fact, Chief, this could start some beef. I'd rather quit rap than have an R&B joint with Tyrese. You can't say I wasn't determined. Leave the same way I walked in.
Oh, Hot Carl, another brilliant idea. Quick, let me call Tony Monty and start getting the single cleared.
Aw, dude, are you joking? What are you talking about? It's becoming obvious why Pete Nice kicked you out. The history of third base is littered with infighting and turmoil, so I basically forced Search to address it in our song, convincing him it was a track where both of us had to face our complex careers.
Don't get it twisted, I left first.
Well, Mr. Big Executive needs to finally get his ego burst. It's all about the art of hip-hop, no matter if it sells.
It's about that Carson Daly and that TRL.
We should talk about my thoughts and ideas. Give me the chance to.
We should talk about recouping that money we just advanced you.
We should talk about the love and the history from the Parks.
Yes, 106 and Park, with free riding your jock.
Man, you got it all wrong. You see, that's not where I'm from.
Listen, hip-hop is a business, man. Don't act dumb.
So I came in here to talk, sit down and show respect, but I haven't been able to get out one word yet.
Carl, you're not listening.
No, listen to me. I was able to get this far, able to resume my passion without being a pop star.
Carl, you're not—
Shut up. Right here, I finally want to get rid of you. Run up in your office like Puffy after Nas's video.
Sheila, get stout on two.
Oh, like what's he gonna do? I'm not a thug, but Hot Carl's gonna run right through.
Yes, Big Carl, that's what I'm talking about. You came in an underground MC, but now look how you're walking out. Now you understand, my boy. You're ready for the plan. Here's your first advance, Chachi. 150 grand.
That's 150 G's?
That's $150,000, Carlito. 150 G's. Can we go to the club now?
Yeah, let's get jiggy. Chapter 19. Spring Breakdown. Months after my decision to walk away from Interscope, my mental state hadn't improved. Where some artists may have been motivated by doubt or determined to prove their haters wrong, I just retreated. As if I needed to be kicked while I was down, I went and saw 8 Mile the day it was released in theaters and realized if you watched it backwards, it was basically my rap career. I went back to therapy twice a week and immediately was put on medication, testing the ability of drugs like Zoloft, Ativan, and Wellbutrin to help combat my constant depression and obsession. As news of my exit traveled around the industry, I started to get calls from insiders, even ones I didn't know, that verified the Interscope employee's story about Eminem's camp squashing my chances. Still, I've never been able to consider it anything more than legend. But anytime anyone encountered evidence or overheard anything that could substantiate the theory, they would let me know in that same way someone tells you that your ex-girlfriend is fucking someone better looking. On my end, one of the first people I had to contact was my publisher. He obviously had a lot to lose in this predicament, but despite the now likely financial loss in his future, he seemed eerily calm. It was like contacting the captain of the Titanic while it was sinking and only hearing about what a gorgeous night it was. He assured me that his gamble wasn't purely dependent on my situation at Interscope and that he knew I'd be back on my feet in no time. He cited a handful of other artists he represented who blew up after complicated releases from major labels, assuring me I'd just be the next in a long line of those who deserved revenge. He suggested a few different acts I could write songs for, and I slowly became optimistic about a second chance. If the man with the most cash invested in my music was unaffected by the recent chain of events, then maybe I was overreacting. During that conversation, although it wasn't an easy task, I tried my hardest to see everything in a different, more positive light. I remember being filled with a sense of possibility after that phone call, especially considering I expected him to declare my career dead and admit to a major misstep in handing me a lavish contract. It truly felt like I had the right team around me to survive this rough patch. But weirdly, despite my good cheer at the time, in one of the weirdest occurrences during my run as Hot Carl, I never really spoke to the publisher again. The most correspondence we had was when I received the termination of my services notice when my contract expired a few years later, where I assumed the publisher would freak out and try every which way to recoup his steep advance of $250,000, I actually experienced quite the opposite, with him sort of just leaving me out there to die. I'd call him frequently to try to get work, and he'd either just avoid my call or small talk me until I figured it was time to hang up. Not shockingly, he left his position soon after and was joked about in the industry for giving out too many expensive, unsubstantiated deals during his tenure. Ironically, he's now the president of one of the largest music publishing companies in the universe, proving none of this shit will ever make sense. Despite the publisher's all-out avoidance and my hope of disappearing without a trace, a few labels did end up getting in touch with me to learn more about what had happened and to see what I planned on doing next. A&R Craig Kalman, who has since become CEO of Atlantic Records, actually found my mom's phone number somewhere on the internet and left a message, saying he hoped to hear any new music I was working on and learn more about a rapper he said was still a hero on the web. When we did eventually talk, I admitted I wasn't even sure I wanted to keep rapping, and understandably his interest waned. Tommy Mottola's office also expressed interest on behalf of Sony after I was brought in to write lyrics for his wife, Latin superstar Talia, who had heard my silly song with Gerardo and wanted to collaborate. Since I was mostly focused on nurturing my own shell shock at the time, most of these inquiries would go unanswered. Whenever I would attempt to go back into the studio to record new music, I would either encounter writer's block or make music that not only lacked any commercial appeal, but would actually bum people the fuck out. One sample lyric went, "Spent 12 months working on a compact disc, which seems like a lot of work for a little piece of shit." Not exactly material for the club. I also entered a few open battles, hoping to get the creative juices flowing, but not only did I tarnish my undefeated streak, I also learned quickly that "used to be dope" rhymed a little too easily with "drop from Interscope." Without any money coming in, I needed to find something to do, not only for my bank account, but for my morale. Feeling the lowest I had ever felt professionally, I decided to search for a real job, the type of job with scheduled hours, a steady paycheck, and no need to listen to beat CDs from grown men named Ayatollah and Megahertz. The question, "where do rappers go to die?" may have been something I was never really ready to ask myself, but now I would be forced to find the answer. After driving by their office's now hiring sign, I applied to be an assistant at a real estate agency near my house. I completely hid my recent musical history, only to be told I was too outgoing for the position and that my personality was better suited to be an agent, a career that would require a new round of schooling, something I couldn't see myself doing yet. One meeting with a headhunter went sour when he asked what the 2-year gap in my work history was all about, and I answered cancer. I meant my father's bout with the sickness, which wasn't exactly true, but I ended up taking it one step too far by mistakenly implying that I was the one with the terminal illness just to hide my silly rap background. She responded with sympathy, and instead of correcting my mistake, I quickly changed the subject, now looking like the asshole who outright ignored her concern. In short, thanks to my straight-out-of-college rap career, I was a bit green when it came to job interviews. I also responded to a few ads on Craigslist, one for a part-time job as a nanny, which I was told within 5 minutes I wasn't right for, and another as part of a marketing sales force, which ended up being a pyramid scheme. I may have been attempting to start careers in brand new fields, but the results were starting to feel very familiar. When I wasn't contacted after turning in an application to work as a flower delivery man, I found myself out of options. I had spent a large chunk of my remaining advance on a new suit to help me start this chapter of my life, since the meds ballooned me to over 200 pounds for the first and only time in my life. The pills weren't working, and I hit a point of depression at which I was willing to do anything to improve my situation. Even rap again. Perfectly timed, in 2002, I was contacted by an independent record label out of New York City that was interested in resurrecting Hot Carl. In the same way that an aging bank robber will do one last heist before he calls it quits for good, only to get shot while on his run to the getaway car, I accepted an offer to once again release music. It paid me in advance of a few $1,000s, which was a bunch of zeros away from what I had made during college, but I knew it would buy me a few more months. I felt absolutely dismal about the prospect of returning to the mic, and this feeling was hard to hide from everyone, including Eddie, the excited young East Coast A&R/label owner who was fronting the money to make it happen. In good faith, Interscope sold him Let's Talk and Something Changed for pennies on the dollar, only to have the latter blocked by separate financial demands from DJ Homicide, who I understood owed me nothing as another name I neglected during my embarrassment of a career downgrade. Another reason I decided I could survive a second record deal was a beat CD Eddie sent me from a guy named Ninth Wonder, who at the time was earning critical acclaim for his work as the producer in the underground rap group Little Brother, and who would later find success with heavyweights like Jay-Z, Beyoncé, Drake, Kendrick Lamar, and J. Cole. I was impressed with what I heard, feeling for the first time since my introduction to Kanye that I was listening to a future superstar. I was finally excited about something in hip-hop, and it helped me rekindle my desire to rap. After freestyling to almost every instrumental in the demo, I asked Eddie to make the connection. He reached out to Ninth, hoping to set up studio time for us to collaborate, only to quickly receive an astounding no as an answer. Even though I had fallen head over heels in love with his work, after hearing my music, Ninth Wonder admitted he wasn't feeling it. There was no way to sugarcoat his feelings. He just didn't want to be associated with any of my music. He wished me luck, but without mincing words, hard passed on the opportunity. I couldn't help but feel the harsh sting of rejection more than ever before. It's easy to see why I titled the eventual album The Great Escape, and why the cover art was a photo of me running away from a gigantic popped champagne bottle, swimsuit-clad models, fancy cars, shiny jewelry, and a luminous rapping shadow lurking above the scene. Some people assumed it referred to my departure from Interscope, but its double meaning was really the only part of the creative I was sure of. I needed to escape not just that label, but the entire industry. Unfortunately, I wasn't quite sure what else I could do. I became jealous of my friends from college who were now, years after graduation, comfortable with companies and careers they had set out to enter, while my experience involved more happenstance and baggy pants. I assumed I'd always have my writing ability to fall back on, but even that was now in question. When pen did eventually hit paper for new songs, my lyrics couldn't find a comfortable place to manifest. One minute I was recording an upbeat dance track called After Party, urging listeners to keep doing shots till it's too hard to think. The next I'd be creating a two-song musical accompaniment to David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, unraveling the story of a young girl who moved to Hollywood only to be left with shattered dreams and a suicide note. My metaphors were never subtle. I thought I was creating a postmodern concept album, allowing fans into the mind of a disoriented artist praying to move on, yet still unable to let go of the club single. But in real life, the results would later force one of my favorite writers, Nathan Rabin, to say in his review of The Great Escape for the AV Club, "Carl's creative soul might not be worth the hassle." Deep down, I knew he was right. Despite my intensely lethargic attitude toward the project, Eddie had set up a few promotional performances before the album would be released. He had produced hundreds of four-song samplers for the album and wanted me to hand them out after concerts, hoping it would lead to album sales once the full length was released. I knew avoiding these shows would be selfish, especially since I happily took his upfront money. I tried my hardest to put on a happy face, but my performances were riddled with mistakes as I battled copious amounts of sweat and pockets where I couldn't catch my breath because of the weight gain. As if my spiritual slump wasn't enough, now my skills were continually declining. We were set up with a residency at the Roxy, the same venue I had sold out years prior and where I had first found out Jimmy Iovine had an interest in signing me. Except instead of performing on that same stage, this time we'd be playing once a week at the small bar above the theater on the rocks. I accepted the offer, assuming my hometown would at least be interested in seeing how I'd reemerge as an independent artist. Much to my chagrin, we never had more than 30 people come see us, and every week the attendance decreased, until by the end of the month, we were performing for a total of 6 people. That night, Maddie thanked someone in the audience for being our biggest fan. When I excitedly asked who, he pointed to a gigantic floor fan near the stage. I deserve that. It was so demoralizing that the final night I jokingly had Sancho play Elliot Smith as I walked off stage. Despite my lack of cooperation or any sign of fandom, the indie label continued to try to get the comeback some traction and booked me a Jamaican spring break tour so I could perform for college kids from around the United States. I was asked to spend almost a week on the island, alongside Maddie and Sancho, rapping at various bars and taking part in a multitude of different activities for the event company footing the bill. I was contractually obligated to promote the album to the best of my abilities, and if I didn't make myself available for something like this, I understood it would make me look unreasonable. I had never been to Jamaica, and I figured some time out of the country would help my psyche, even if I had to participate in an activity I despised. How difficult could rapping to a bunch of drunk college kids be? And I'm a big Cool Runnings fan. So I accepted the offer, understanding it would probably be the last big effort I put into my rap career anyway. I would soon find out it would have to be. When we arrived in Jamaica, we were told we'd be staying at Hedonism 2, a resort that sounded like a sequel to a low-budget Cinemax movie, and for good reason. Touted as the world's top nudist resort, it was singles and swinger-friendly, with most of the premises advertised as clothing optional. The promoter said they selected the resort because it was clear of any college kids, and would be a good place for us to relax in between shows. I'd assume we'd be smack dab in the middle of a Playboy shoot, looking at impressive naked bodies nonstop, but upon arrival at the resort, it didn't take long to realize that the people abandoning their swimsuits were not the types you'd ever want to see naked. It was more like a racy rap party for the movie Cocoon. Our first encounter with the over 60 set was near the hotel's check-in. The group's floppy penises and saggy boobs doubled as some sort of satanic hotel greeter. It was like an in-real-life lemon party. Naked senior citizens were everywhere we turned, most disturbingly in line for the all-you-can-eat buffet, where sneeze guards have never been more important. It was not the type of starting point I'd hoped for. For the entire week, we didn't see one naked person who we'd voluntarily have sex with, despite being propositioned for the task several times. We were scheduled to perform a series of shows throughout the week at bars with names like The Jungle and Risky Business, mostly jumping on stage in between DJs paid to make underage kids drunk enough to end up sleeping on the beach or getting an awful tattoo, dance to Britney Spears remixes. With my experience at Bling Bling, I assumed I'd be an expert with this crowd, only to be blindsided once we took the stage for the first time. The DJ announced our name in an annoyed tone, like the way someone might introduce their embarrassing mom after being forced to do so with a question like, "Aren't you going to introduce me to your friends?" He seemed to see us as a nuisance, breaking up his killer set, rather than as the headlining act, an opinion the audience apparently shared. We started our first song to a cluster of boos, with most of the crowd immediately leaving to go get another Jaeger shot or Long Island iced tea or whatever you drink when you're a piece of shit kid. We performed from a balcony, looking down on the dance floor that at one time had been packed with patrons and was now completely deserted. At the end of one song, I announced, "Stick around because Bob Marley is up next. He's alive, guys." And I didn't see a flinch. I quickly realized that no one was listening and I was in Jamaica for no reason at all. The second show was no better, this time with a cup of water thrown at me for good measure. The energy that at one time defined a hot Carl performance and helped me stand out was now replaced with a lethargic complacency and a desire to cut every song short. I would finish these sets completely defeated, then return to our naked geriatric hotel just to hide in my room, while Maddie and Sancho would tour the grounds for adventure and eventually see an elderly couple banging in the jacuzzi. I was alone in my quarters, pretending to play Game Boy, but in reality, totally breaking down. My body was rejecting every attempt I made to be a rapper, physically trying to stop me from continuing to take the stage each time. I would feel sick before, after, and during every gig. If the bed covers weren't over my head, I was riddled with panic. This is how my body decided to deal with trauma. I'd started another new anti-anxiety pill, but was still a few weeks away from feeling its effects. I was also unable to call my therapist from abroad. The luxury of international smartphones had not arrived yet, so I was without any professional help for the time being. That night we had our first late-night show, which I dreaded even more than the day parties because I assumed the teens would be even drunker and even less receptive to rap songs that referenced obscure Annie Hall lines. Even though I knew the chances were slim, I genuinely prayed I'd be performing in a cage, like the Blues Brothers at Bob's Country Bunker in Kokomo. I knew this night was destined for disaster. I have some recollections of that night, mostly out of order and somewhat cloudy. But I know that once I hit the stage, I turned on an autopilot I didn't even know existed. In order to perform, I had to leave my own body and basically watch from afar, ignoring the boos, ignoring the dude who every few seconds yelled, "fuck you," and ignoring the club's speakers, which sounded like they were occupied by small children beatboxing my tracks into a megaphone. A few feet from the stage, one drunk girl vomited in the middle of our second song, and the smell instantly circulated around the space. I audibly gagged before introducing the next track to the uninterested crowd by just asking aloud, "what the fuck are we all doing here?" Maddie looked at me like I was a maniac, which made sense, because I was. It was hands down the worst performance of my life, so much so that I forced Sancho to skip the last three songs and rush into our finale. I was nauseous and dizzy and needed to get home. And by home, I didn't mean that weird episode of Real Sex we were staying in. I meant home as in back to Los Angeles, where I could get the help I so desperately needed. The bright light shined on my face as I barely mumbled out the words to our last song. Each individual drum kick shook my vision. As soon as I rapped my final word, I dropped the mic and ran outside the club for any sense of relief or fresh air. I knew I was having an intense panic attack and frantically searched for an open cab that would take me back to Hedonism 2. Sancho and Maddie would stay behind to drink, assuming I had a stomachache, an alibi I'd created much earlier in the day in case something like this happened. By the time I got back to the hotel, I felt seconds away from fainting. I stumbled into my room, running past grotesque nudity at every corner, and fell onto my bed. My OTD had hit a climax, with only negative thoughts now flooding into my consciousness. "You failed. Your father's cancer will come back. You're going to run out of money. You've lost your skills. You have no plan. No one loves you and no one will. I want to die." I couldn't find a moment of solace. I turned on the television to shift my focus, but couldn't stop pacing the room. I screamed as loud as I could. I searched the room for anything to help. I threw a pillow, hoping the aggression would release some tension. It didn't. I ran a shower, thinking it would calm me, but the bathroom felt so small and constricted that I couldn't spend another second standing in it. I was terrified, and while I had been experiencing panic attacks since childhood, this one felt different. "You failed. Your father's cancer will come back. You're going to run out of money. You've lost your skills. You have no plan. No one loves you and no one will. I want to die." A few seconds later, I saw my bottle of pills on the bedside table. I needed to stop the thoughts. There was no alternative plan. I knew I couldn't survive the night feeling this kind of pain. I had taken my prescribed dosage earlier that day and was yet to feel its effects. I opened the bottle and counted 11 Ativan pills left. I knew I was making a foolish decision, especially since I had drunk a few beers at the show, but something had to be done. So to silence my thoughts and finally have a moment of clarity, I downed the 11 pills with a glass of water. I knew there was a possibility of never waking up or falling into a coma, and I still felt I had to do it. If this was my last night, I understood that I could no longer face this struggle. I just needed to fall asleep. If that meant dying, I had to accept that. I sat on the edge of my bed and practiced breathing deeply, trying to finally relax. "You failed. Your father's cancer will come back. You're going to run out of money. You've lost your skills. You have no." That's the last thing I remember until I heard my door open 8 hours later. I woke up the next afternoon, laid out on the floor with the room spinning. The resort's housekeeper had just unlocked my door to see me posing for a crime scene chalk outline, an image that I'm sure was nowhere near the scariest she's ever walked in on. I turned on my side to ask her to come back later, only to realize I was lying next to a puddle of my own vomit. The housekeeper got the message and quickly left. My mouth was dry, and my body felt like it had just gone 5 rounds with Tito Ortiz. I ran to the bathroom to throw up, but didn't make it to the toilet, missing by just a few feet and hurling onto the floor. I looked in the mirror, stunned at the shell that now stood before me. I was bloated and pale, with a huge bruise on my shoulder from where I probably fell from the bed. I made my way back to the scene of the crime, thankful I hadn't choked on the vomit in my sleep. I'd already missed an earlier event I was supposed to host, and knew I had one more show before we were to go home. I cleaned the mess and somehow managed to make it out of my room, each ray of sunlight stinging my skin as it was exposed. No sunglasses were dark enough to save me. I met Maddie and Sancho at a bar, where we were whisked away to perform a song and judge something I don't recommend anyone having a mental breakdown sit through: a wet t-shirt contest. As each girl doused herself with water, hoping we'd validate her with a score high enough to get her and her friends free shots, I could barely hold up the numbered signs they gave me. If I wasn't already disappointed enough in the choices I had made, being disappointed in others' choices really was the final straw. When they'd asked me for my opinion, I could hardly speak, and when I did, I asked where their parents were, like the world's biggest boner killer. I walked off stage at one point to throw up in the bushes. After crowning the victor, I sped through my one song, this time to surprisingly interested or just horny kids, and got back to my room as quickly as I could. I told Maddie and Sancho that I was still battling the flu, and neither suspected anything otherwise. I stayed in my room for our final night in Jamaica, recovering from the extreme distress I'd put my body through over the past 24 hours. I drank enough Gatorade to fuel an entire World Cup and faded in and out of a deep sleep, only to wake up in the middle of the night, finally rested enough to rejoin humanity. I contemplated calling the guys to fill them in on what had happened, but there was no need to alarm them, especially because I assumed they were both busy watching a 60-year-old fingerbang his wife for a crowd. I was awake and thankful to have survived. After regaining my energy, I decided to pull out a pen and paper and write to one of those forbidden Ninth Wonder beats, determined to finally be honest about what I was facing and answer the producer's understandable criticisms. I was no longer interested in making the listener laugh or dance or vote for my song on a countdown show. I gave up trying to be witty and just focused on honesty. As a result, I wrote the majority of a song called I've Heard, a track that unapologetically faces every ounce of insecurity and sadness I encountered as an MC, written at the only time in my life I was vulnerable enough to do so. It mimicked every obsessive thought that echoed through my head while I was trying to salvage a life that had gotten out of hand. Once I finished writing, I rapped the lyrics over the phone on Eddie's voicemail. He then played it for Ninth Wonder. After listening to the message, Ninth gave his blessing for the song, and we recorded it just in time to make the album's track list. As a result, I made the one song that every critic praised, and fans to this day still tell me they connect with the most. It's also the only one of my tracks I can still listen to. Fittingly, it was the last song I'd ever write as Hot Carl, and that trip would mark my last professional show ever. I remember leaving Hedonism 2 for the airport, still fighting off nausea and exhaustion while keeping my secret. On my walk to the shuttle, I suddenly noticed our hotel's view of the ocean, a beautiful scene I had completely taken for granted all week, too caught up in my own bullshit. As I stood there, surveying the scenery, I knew no matter what hardships I'd face moving forward or how many false starts I'd had, this was my last stand. I looked at the H and the K tattooed on my wrists and didn't feel the regret I expected, but rather the relief of letting go. The beauty of that view helped me understand there was an entire world out there for me to explore, and I was ready to start looking. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw some movement about a mile down the beach. I waved, thinking it was Maddie and Sancho walking up to join me for our departure. It was perfect timing. I readied myself to tell them the news. Squinting, I realized it was two old people fucking. And just like that, the world was terrifying again. I've Heard lyrics, 2001, 22 years old. I've heard I'm always corny and I'm only punchlines. I tread on thin water, oceans filled with landmines. I've heard I copy Eminem with everything I write. But I guess there's worse rappers that a cat could sound like. I've heard I made a stupid move by leaving that place, ditching a CD that Redman, Fab, and Maya laced. I've heard I'm just a gimmick that cashes in on a fad. Well, if it's so hot, why's my career so bad? I've heard I got a $1 million deal based on a lie. I signed the contract and then ran away to hide. I've heard my parents' divorce had fucked with my mind, popping Ativan, panic attacks all the time. I've heard that independent means I'm not good enough. If it's not on MTV, then my whole album must suck. I've heard I'm either selling 4 million or just 4. I'm that dude you love to hate, but that dude you can't ignore. I've heard my money's running out, I better find new hope. But then I heard that Kanye West and Just Blaze still think I'm dope. I've heard I wasted 4 years of my life on pipe dreams. If I'm asked again what happened, then I'm gonna fucking scream. I've heard my girlfriend try to convince me of my skills. I don't think that I'm whack, I'm just sick of standing still. I've heard that Playboy Mag said I'm next to blow up, but that was 3 years ago and now I feel I've dried up. I've heard that Timbaland talk shit behind my back, but I can't really tell what's just made up and what's fact. I've heard that message boards are filled with only haters, but still I gotta peep them out sooner or later. I've heard in this game there's only room for one white, although 90% of all rappers are virtually alike. I've heard I got Muhammad Ali up on my arm to remind me to keep fighting and to always stay strong. Is that wrong? I've heard I can't relate because I never sold drugs, like every rapper out really did grow up as a thug. Because of this divide, I know my passion's slowly dying, only because these popular MCs keep lying. I've heard that no one likes that I'm a true throwback. No one cares about MC Light, Biz Markie, or G-Rap. I've heard a lot of compliments about my different style, but I'm convinced that they're lying, so I'm nervous all the while. I've heard that this record might be my last chance, but I can't find myself doing the same song and dance. I heard it would be easy if I just gave in, but I couldn't live with myself if I just caved in. I've heard that I'm stuck fighting a lost cause. At least I'm being honest, show the world I got some balls. I've heard this is my heart and soul all on one track. I've heard a lot of things, but all I want to do is rap. I always romanticize the idea that the last line I ever wrote would be, all I want to do is rap. It's the state of mind I had as a teen, and I wanted to be the edict I gave while walking away. Looking back, it also would have been funny to say, all I want to do is nap. Outro. Over the next decade, I moved on, leaving Hot Carl as part of a past life that I never wanted mentioned, like I was Disney casting Tim Allen as Santa Claus and hoping kids would never find out that he was once arrested for smuggling 1.4 pounds of cocaine. If someone asked about the story, or God forbid was a fan, I would laugh it off and quickly find a way out of the conversation. Whenever a video of me rapping would pop up on YouTube, I would immediately flag it for removal. The easiest way for me to get over the letdown was to pretend it never happened, and I needed everyone to play along. This was a mandatory step to help control my obsessive thoughts disorder, alongside years of intensive therapy, light medication, and a new dependence on my favorite hobby for spiritual growth, running. Whenever I encountered my own indignation or sadness about the demise of Hot Carl, I'd get up and run a few miles, allowing my brain to find somewhere else, somewhere safe to go. And when my most repetitive fear did come true and my father passed away from cancer, I stayed strong and survived. His advice to find happiness, to finally accept and celebrate what I experienced as Hot Carl, was crucial. I knew he was right, but it was like asking Bill Buckner to go play first base at Shea Stadium again. There was trauma there, and I didn't know how or when to face it. I never expected that Howard Stern would help me make that decision. Howard had become obsessed with the roll call after finding out that a member of his staff was involved in producing the contest's New York incarnation. Even though it hadn't been on either coast airwaves in years, he found it to be ridiculous regional radio, it was, and couldn't wrap his brain around why people enjoyed it. I heard him mocking it on and off for a few months and laughed, figuring he'd soon forget about the topic and move on to something else. However, after listening to a year of Howard continually discussing it, even getting 50 Cent to participate during an appearance, I had a feeling I'd somehow get mentioned. When one of Howard's producers contacted me in 2011 to call into the show, I almost felt like I was being pranked. Mostly because of his demons, my father and I didn't find much to bond over late in his life. Howard was everything to our relationship, though. My father was a proud New Yorker who enjoyed explaining the postmodernism and importance of an East Coast pioneer like Howard to his young son, who rarely left LA and was happy at the time with his West Coast sense of humor. I became a superfan immediately as we laughed together listening to the show. We even saw Private Parts at the first midnight screening in our neighborhood during my junior year of high school. Howard was on the radio every time I drove my father to chemotherapy. One of my father's last birthday gifts to me was a Sirius radio subscription, which helped me follow the show to satellite radio without missing a broadcast. I even vividly remember listening to Howard the day my father died. The fact that this common bond would push me to finally admit and accept my past, the exact advice my father gave me days before he left me forever, is a spiritual coincidence on par with Patrick Swayze helping you make pottery. Howard interviewed me for almost 15 minutes, asking about the odd events that took me from conscientious college student to lauded up-and-coming rapper, then back down to regular guy. After being shown my picture, Howard lovingly observed that I looked like Woody Allen, and Robin less lovingly joked, "No wonder your career went nowhere." I tried my hardest to contain my excitement, especially when we jokingly performed a roll call together and Howard earnestly said, "Wow, you're good." It was something I was thrilled to hear. Not only had it felt like a lifetime since I talked about Hot Carl, it felt just as long since I'd rapped. I hung up the phone, once again having one of the best moments of my life on the radio, feeling like millions of pounds had been lifted off my shoulders. What was once embarrassment now felt like success. I wasn't quite chomping at the bit to get back in the studio and resurrect Hot Carl. I had found a comfortable life outside the business. But thanks to this interview, I no longer felt like a victim. So when I was diagnosed with brain tumors and facing mortality soon after, I knew that finally telling my story was the next and last step of acceptance. Well, almost. A year later, I was having lunch with my friend Justin when I looked up and was stunned to see Jimmy Iovine and his children entering the restaurant. I had played out this scenario in my head hundreds of times, what I'd say to Jimmy now that I was a grown man unafraid to express his own thoughts and opinions. But only a few feet away from him, I once again froze. My heart started to race, and I felt the sweat start to build, and despite a long time passing, I felt like I was once again walking up to his house, hoping he'd change my life forever. I had already made amends with DJ, as we occasionally texted each other, mostly about the Clippers, a team we both have season tickets for, mine in the 200 section, his courtside. We had never dug deep into Ha Carl, or ever addressed how he and the project just vanished, but at this point I don't really need those answers from him. Now that I was facing the actual decision maker, my repressed feelings of contempt and obsession came back at an alarmingly fast speed. Justin, the friend I was having lunch with, immediately noticed my obvious discomfort and asked what was wrong. Knowing that Justin had also worked for Interscope at some point in his life, with a much less dramatic departure, I pointed out Jimmy and frowned. Justin turned around to see, and I went back to eating, of all things, a salmon plate. Acknowledging the coincidence, I started to think back on everything that had happened. I couldn't help but laugh, all this because of a bar mitzvah. I had always concentrated on the painful conclusion, yet at this moment I couldn't help but focus on the happier times. Street performing for Missy, Cisco's porn collection, Mac-10's briefcase, Suge Knight's kindness, my phone call with RZA, my A-list eye infection, loaning money to Kanye West, forcing my poor mom to dress in numerous ridiculous costumes, and my dad yelling, "Go get 'em," from side stage. I was a person with stories that no one else could tell. For the first time in my life, I felt pride in being that person. Filled with that newfound confidence, I looked at Justin and said, "Let's go say hello." Justin, understanding the importance of this statement, silently stood up and followed my lead. When we got to his table, Jimmy immediately recognized Justin and greeted him, introduced his kids, and asked how he was doing. I stood by patiently, listening to the small talk, wondering how everything would go down, and trying my hardest not to focus on the nicely sharpened knives on the table. After a few minutes, which felt like hours, Justin turned to me and said, "And you know Jensen." I watched as Jimmy's mind worked overtime, trying to recognize the face and name he knew were familiar but was unable to place. I broke the silence with a sentence I hadn't said in quite some time. "I'm Hot Carl." He looked surprised, unable to hold the poker face that has probably made him billions of dollars in infamous negotiations. His son Jamie, who had joined our initial meeting back in the day, now in his 20s, was stunned but tickled by my announcement. I could tell Jimmy was also happy to see me, something that threw my plan off. He instantly started asking sincere questions about my life, and I filled him in, letting him know that I owned two art galleries in Los Angeles and was writing for a few TV shows and websites. When he asked if I still made music, I shook my head no. I noticed his son was visibly upset at this admission. Then a club DJ, Jamie reminded me that I was one of his favorite rappers, and that felt better than I would have expected. Jimmy asked if I ever thought about doing it again. I laughed and revealed that, now over 30, I was well past my prime. I explained that I was happy falling back on my college education, something he'd actually helped pay for. Without missing a step, Jimmy cracked, "You and everyone else at this table." After the resulting laughter, Jamie asked the question I've been asked a million times, something even I'd ask myself if given the opportunity. It's the same thing you've probably wondered throughout this entire book. It was an inquiry that normally reopened the wound, something I would have gone out of my way to avoid in this encounter, but now I had to face it. "So what happened, man? You were so dope. And then you just disappeared. It was like the ending of The Sopranos," Jamie said earnestly. I waited a second, shocked I would get to respond to this in front of the only man who actually knew the answer, and the only person I wanted to hear me. I wanted to say a million things. The anger wanted out. I opened my mouth to ruin a perfectly good lunch, and then remembered my father's advice. I had grown. I had moved on. There was no reason to revive the gloom. Despite how it ended, I was given an opportunity and I took advantage of it. I had the time of my life, and I accepted how it ended. No matter how much I had fantasized about delivering a resentful and threatening response, I earnestly joked, "Well, it would be like The Sopranos if the actors didn't know the show was ending." I kind of didn't want to stop. I saw Jimmy nod his head. With that, we said our goodbyes. Jimmy was friendly and seemed genuinely interested in my life, which was a nice feeling considering everything I had assumed. It was the respectful and mature closure I knew was best. Before I left, Jimmy made a big deal out of giving me his email address, saying he'd love to meet and see if there was any way he could get me back into the fold, this time far away from the microphone. He remembered my work ethic and marketing mind, saying I was ahead of my time and possibly now a professional asset. I thanked him and walked away, proud of myself and well aware of the growth I had just exhibited. "Well, that went well," Justin observed with a sense of relief. I emailed Jimmy a few days later, letting him know it was great to see him after all these years and that I was happy to see his beautiful family. I told him the days I was available to meet and that I look forward to fully catching up. I sent the message knowing this was a whole new Jensen. Hot Carl was finally just a happy memory. Jimmy never emailed me back. P.S. To find a happier ending for me, and ultimately Hot Carl, visit jensencarp.com and see what I've been up to since Jamaica. This is Jensen Karp. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Kanye West Owes Me $300 and other true stories from a white rapper who almost made it big. This program was directed by Aaron Spencer, executive producer Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2016 by Jensen Karp. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.